This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm David Greene. Let's continue now with Morning Edition's revolutionary road trip, a journey through nations of the Arab Spring. Steve Inskeep is traveling about 2,000 miles through Tunisia, Libya, and Egypt from Carthage to Cairo.
Okay, we're in the car, the window's down, the radio's on. We've just left Tunisia. We're moving along the highway after getting our passport stamped at the western border crossing into Libya and checking in with the militia also at the border with anti-aircraft guns mounted on the backs of pickup trucks.
Many armed groups operate checkpoints on the roads, all of them loyal to Libya's revolution, though not necessarily taking anyone's orders. The road leads past scenes of last year's fighting, building after building, pockmarked with holes as if struck by disease. It also leads past an oil refinery, where flames burn once again atop the smokestacks. Then you reach Tripoli, where militiamen briefly took over the airport the other day, yet the capital glitters by its harbor and is filling again with life. We saw school children pouring through a doorway, coming out of the sun, into a centuries-old castle by the water. That castle is now a museum, which just reopened for the first time since the war. The kids are experiencing something that is new for Libya, a perfectly normal day. Of course, their country does not have a normal recent history. We begin exploring Libya at this museum because much of our reporting along the road from here involves Libya's reckoning with the not-so-distant past. We're taking a stroll through Libya's National Museum. Arranged around this fountain are artifacts from the ancient Roman period, 2,000 years ago and more, spectacular statues and gravestones that have been brought in from along the coastline and even deep into the Libyan desert. There used to be some more recent artifacts in this room where I've just walked, a couple of vehicles associated with Muammar Gaddafi, including a Volkswagen Beetle that it said he drove in the 1960s. Those vehicles have now been put in storage. An employee here, Najat Benhamida, showed us where artifacts glorifying Gaddafi's 42-year rule used to occupy much of the fourth floor. Now the floor is bare, the document display cases empty.
Contracts and everything here was belonged to Gaddafi.
What sort of documents? All kinds of documents, she says, seeming never to have paid much attention to them. Elsewhere, the museum staff have done the equivalent of repairing their history with duct tape, putting Libyan flag stickers over displays that gave Gaddafi's personal name for Libya, the Great Socialist People's Libyan Arab Jamahuriya. More permanent changes to Libya's history will take time. But many Libyans are now telling their own personal histories of the last few decades. We heard one such story just down the street from the museum when we sat down with a man named Omar El-Shakmak.
I was hiding during the last 30 years my activity in the Libyan National Front, opposition Libyan National Front.
Over tiny cups of espresso, he told us a story he could never have revealed just a year or two ago, a story of how he very quietly joined that opposition group. Today, he's the deputy oil minister in Libya's new government. We were sitting in a hotel by a window with a view of ships in Tripoli's harbor, and Shekmak shook off his blue blazer as we talked.
Make yourself comfortable. It's a little warm in the sunlight, I know. Would you remind me how long you have worked in the oil ministry or for the government of Libya?
I joined the oil industry in January 1977.
He worked as an accountant in an ammonia plant. He worked for two decades in an oil refinery, hours from any major city. He became an official in a state-owned oil company, and he often couldn't believe how the regime spent the billions of dollars he was helping to make.
For example, when you hear about money being paid to some other government in Africa, and you knew that there is no added value at all to the Libyan people, to the economy. Of course, so we'll keep people frustrated.
Which helps to explain why Shekmek joined the Libyan National Front, that opposition group, even as he continued working for the oil firm. When traveling abroad, he passed on information to Libyan opposition leaders in exile. And then, in 1985, he was arrested by Gaddafi's government.
Were you tortured?
Yes.
I'm sorry to ask, but in what way? What did they do?
They do a lot. They do a lot. But to tell you the way how they put you... excuse me. No, just,
I should wait here?
No, just I want you to see...
He stands and leads the way to a more private spot. And here he suddenly sits against a wall. He tucks his arms beneath his raised knees and holds his hands together.
They put your hand like this, mm-hmm. and then they tied it, okay? And then automatically they pull you, and then you find yourself just like that.
They're pulling you by a chain that's your
yes.
feeder.
This is one way. The other way, they hang you upside down.
Shekmak was released in 1986. People in the Libyan National Front knew he couldn't risk more work with them. They told him instead to simply stay inside the oil company because someday the opposition would need people with experience to run that industry.
People who are clean, people who have not been involved in corruption, qualified and efficient persons.
You're telling me that 25 years before the revolution finally happened,
yes.
people were, including you, were trying to prepare to be ready for that
yes.
moment.
The moment finally came last year. Two of his sons were involved in the revolution. One was imprisoned by Gaddafi's forces in Tripoli. The other joined a rebel fighting force that moved into Tripoli when Gaddafi's forces fled. The two sons were reunited at the bombed-out ruins of Gaddafi's compound. And Shekmak has helped to oversee the rapid revival of Libya's oil industry, which is now back up to 90% of its pre-war production. The deputy minister arranged for us to see the oil terminal at the port of Sidra in what was a Libyan war zone. The facility manager, Abu Jalla Zanati, climbed the stairs to a room with a view of the Mediterranean.
So this is actually our control room here.
Okay.
A few miles out at sea, two massive oil tankers rode at anchor, sucking in Libyan oil from undersea pipes. This place was wrecked during the war, but workers relayed new pipes and bypassed destroyed equipment. Walking across the grounds on the shore today, you can smell the money Libya is making from more than 300,000 barrels of oil that pass through this port on a typical day. That smell, is that the smell of crude oil?
Well, actually, yes. We had a little bit of leak over there.
Building walls have been patched where they were punctured by shells, though a few signs of combat remain in the walls of Zanati's office.
So this is a bullet hole in the organization shirt?
Yeah.
Good thing you weren't at work then.
Yeah.
Zanati is at work now, and the same oil income that fueled the excesses of Muammar Gaddafi now gives him confidence that Libya can earn a better future. We're traveling the Revolutionary Road from Carthage to Cairo through nations of the Arab Spring. We're back in the car. And tomorrow, the road takes us to the scene of some of the Libyan war's heaviest fighting and an ongoing act of vengeance that the United Nations calls a crime against humanity.
They have tortured and killed and displaced and burned fields and houses. And they have committed the ultimate sin in our culture and our religion, which is rape. All coming from a supposedly a good neighbor, you know.
Should they be allowed to return?
Not in my lifetime, I don't think.
And we have much more from our revolutionary road trip online. You can also read about Steve's visit to a Tunisian city with some Hollywood ties. It's where parts of Raiders of the Lost Ark was filmed. That's at our pop culture blog, Monkey See, at npr.org.